KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
It's possible that the rate of evolution has slowed down a little bit, but the evolution of the virus has not stopped.
For many, COVID-19 is in the rearview mirror, but the virus behind that disease is still spreading and steadily mutating.
Today is Tuesday, March 11th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. President Trump plans to impose a 25% tax on all imported steel and aluminum starting tomorrow.
When a product is tariffed, the price rises for both domestically produced and imported products.
Also, the Department of Government Efficiency has been seeking access to databases that store personal information on millions of Americans.
That has alarmed some federal workers and privacy advocates.
It's not normally a couple of weird guys who we're not exactly sure who they work for, who they report to, or what they do.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Military chiefs from over 30 countries met in Paris today to discuss forming an international security force for Ukraine. The goal is to enforce a potential ceasefire and deter further Russian aggression. Rebecca Rossman has more from Paris.
Military leaders are working on what British Prime Minister Keir Starmer calls a coalition of the willing, a joint European and NATO force to secure Ukraine and counter Russia. French President Emmanuel Macron, who attended today's talks, stressed that Europe must take charge of Ukraine's security, especially as U.S. support grows uncertain. Notably, the U.S. was not invited. Discussions focused on NATO-backed security guarantees and the possibility of European troop deployments away from front lines to enforce a peace deal. Five top European defense ministers will meet in Paris on Wednesday to move plans forward. Rebecca Rossman, NPR News, Paris.
U.S. Energy Secretary Chris Wright told a gathering of energy executives Monday the Biden administration's focus on climate change was short-sighted and hurt consumers. NPR's Michael Copley reports Wright called climate change a side effect of economic development.
Speaking at an energy conference in Houston, Wright said the U.S. needs a lot more energy to support economic growth, including data centers for artificial intelligence. With electricity demand rising, Wright touted the importance of natural gas, while downplaying the role of renewables, like wind and solar. But industry analysts and executives say clean energy is crucial for meeting growing power demand. They say renewable energy and battery plants are quick to build and generate electricity that's relatively cheap. Meanwhile, a backlog of gas turbines is holding up development of natural gas plants. Michael Copley, NPR News.
California's almond growers are used to dealing with vagaries in terms of the weather and water supplies. Now they have something else to add to the list, the Trump tariffs' effects on global markets. The uncertainty of the administration's tariff policy may well play a role in where farmers shipped their crops. The state is the world's largest producer of almonds. More than three-quarters of California's almond crop is headed for export. President Trump is defending his administration's policy on putting tariffs in place against other countries as a way of boosting the U.S. economy, while backing off from a threat to impose even larger tariffs on Canadian steel and aluminum. 25% tariffs are still set to take effect tomorrow. Speaking at the White House today, Trump said the tariffs will bring the nation more money and jobs.
The tariffs are having a tremendously positive impact. They will have, and they are having. We have car companies that are not building in Mexico now. They're building in the United States.
But the stock market and many economists appear to disagree with the president's assessment. Some economists are upping their estimates of a possible U.S. recession sharply. The stock market was at record highs just a month ago, has fallen sharply also. The Dow was up 478 points. This is NPR. President Trump, in a show of support for his appointed government cost-cutter Elon Musk, announced today he's buying one of Musk's Tesla electric cars. The announcement by Trump comes at a time Tesla has seen its stock hammered. At least some of the company's vehicles have been vandalized since Musk has dedicated himself to downsizing the federal government. Tesla shares are down about 40% this year, though they do see a bit of a bump today. Billy Joel is postponing his current tour. As NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports, the Grammy-winning singer and songwriter will take 4 months off due to an undisclosed medical condition.
The statement on Billy Joel's Instagram says the singer will postpone his tour so he can recover from recent surgery and undergo physical therapy. The singer says, quote, "While I regret postponing any shows, my health must come first." The statement says the tour will resume in Pittsburgh in July. Shows that will be rescheduled include dates in the U.S., Canada, and the U.K. The statement says purchased tickets will be valid for the rescheduled shows.
Sing us a song, you're the piano man. Sing us a song tonight.
Joel writes he looks forward to getting back on stage and sharing the joy of live music with his fans. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
Another of the hallmarks differentiating Southwest from other airlines is apparently going away: two free checked bags. Southwest says starting May 28th, most passengers will have to pay for checked bags. Those who have reached the upper tiers of the carrier's Rapid Rewards loyalty program, purchased a business class ticket, or have a Southwest credit card will get a break on that. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Kresge Foundation. Established 100 years ago, the Kresge Foundation works to expand equity and opportunity in cities across America. A century of impact, a future of opportunity. More at Kresge.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. 5 years after the pandemic erupted, COVID-19 has receded into the background for most people. But the virus behind the disease is still spreading widely and is still steadily mutating. NPR health correspondent Rob Stein brings us this look at the evolution of the deadly virus.
When the virus first emerged, many scientists thought this frightening new respiratory infection would evolve slowly. But that was one of the first big surprises from SARS-CoV-2. This virus, it evolved like crazy.
SARS-CoV-2 so far has probably been even faster than influenza virus, which is really remarkable.
Jesse Bloom studies viral evolution at the Fred Hutch Cancer Center in Seattle.
I thought it would undergo some evolution, but the speed at which it's undergone that evolution and the ability it's shown to undergo these big evolutionary jumps is really remarkable.
Most notoriously, like when the virus made a huge evolutionary jump to spawn Omicron, which conquered the world with shocking speed, and that hasn't changed. The virus has kept mutating, regularly begetting new variants.
It's possible that the rate of evolution has slowed down a little bit, but the evolution of the virus has not stopped.
But the menagerie of new mutants have pretty much all been descendants of Omicron, offspring that keep finding new ways to get around our immune systems. But something else has changed big time: the human immune system.
As we got infected by the virus, but also really importantly, as we saw the vaccines roll out, that just built up immunity in the population, which means that SARS-CoV-2 all of a sudden ran into this immunity wall.
Christian Anderson is an evolutionary biologist at the Scripps Research Institute in California.
And with the immunity wall, we have SARS-CoV-2 at least a little bit cornered now, and is probably mostly in stasis by now because of that immunity wall.
And it's that immunity wall that keeps most people from getting very ill. Now, that doesn't mean the virus isn't a threat anymore. It hasn't evolved to become inherently less dangerous, and it still makes lots of people sick, sometimes so sick they wind up in the hospital or even die. Hundreds perish every week in the U.S. from COVID, mostly older people and people with other health problems. But the virus has essentially become endemic, meaning this is the new normal. The virus is here to stay, but isn't upending daily life anymore. Jeremy Camille is an immunologist at the University of Pittsburgh.
The immunity we built up, it makes it like trying to start a forest fire after a few weeks of heavy rain versus when everything's tinder dry.
But the virus will keep evolving, trying to find new ways to sneak around our immunity wall. But most scientists think it isn't likely to morph enough to cause more than mild illness for most people. Michael Warby studies the evolution of viruses at the University of Arizona.
We may just continue on in this phase of subvariants of subvariants of subvariants of Omicron might just be what we deal with for decades and decades.
With some years and some surges being better or worse than others, kind of like the flu, and with the chances being low that a much more dangerous new variant will suddenly erupt again. Experts stress, however, that's not guaranteed. Jennifer Nuzzo of Brown University's Pandemic Center says it's crucial we maintain our immunity wall.
That wall of immunity is something that is built up over time, but it also can erode over time. And so to keep up that wall, we need to make sure we continue to protect ourselves.
By getting vaccinated with updated vaccines once or twice a year to bolster waning immunity. Experts say that would help minimize the chances the virus would spread to someone, say, with a weak immune system, where the virus could simmer and mutate and make yet another dangerous evolutionary jump. Rob Stein, NPR News.
The Department of Government Efficiency created by President Trump has been making its way through the federal workforce. In addition to cutting staff, DOGE, as it's more commonly known, has also been seeking access to the troves of personal information that the government has on Americans. And in some cases, they're getting it. For more, we're joined now by NPR's Laurel Wamsley. Hi there.
Hey, Juana.
So, Laurel, before we get into the DOGE of it all, I just want to ask you, what kind of information is it that the government keeps on us? It's actually, I think, a lot deeper than a lot of people realize.
Yeah, it's a whole range of stuff. I mean, it's not just your name, home address, date of birth. Some agencies, because of what they do, have a lot more than that. Take the IRS. It has everything you file in your taxes, how much money you make, who your dependents are, whether you've ever declared bankruptcy. And then there's the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid that has people's personal health information. And for veterans who receive care through the VA, the agency could have records of mental health issues and treatment, even notes from therapy sessions. And DOGE, the team led by Elon Musk, has been trying to get access to pretty much everything these agencies have, including Americans' personal information. But they aren't necessarily accessing all of it, even if it's there.
Laurel, what can you tell us about why the DOGE team has been trying to get access to this information?
Yeah, well, DOGE does stand for the Department of Government Efficiency, and Musk says that he's targeting waste and fraud. Back in January, President Trump signed an executive order instructing agency heads to ensure that DOGE has full access to all unclassified agency records, software systems, and IT systems to, quote, the maximum extent consistent with law. And we've seen this play out at agencies across the federal government. Staff are told that representatives from DOGE are coming, and they quickly need access to the building and all of its systems. And then DOGE staff start poking around in the data, and it's often not clear what they're doing. Leaders at agencies, including the VA, Social Security, and Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, have tried to quell concerns, and they say that DOGE has only limited access to personal data.
Now, I know that you've been talking with federal workers. What have you been hearing?
Yeah, many career staff have been alarmed by all of this. I spoke to Erie Meyer, who was chief technologist at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau until she resigned last month. She said DOGE staffers there were given what's called God-tier access, full access to the Bureau's systems that even she didn't have because it requires careful approval.
Making sure that we're not exposing people's information other than to those who need to know to execute the jobs we have as determined by Congress. It's not normally a couple of weird guys who we're not exactly sure who they work for, who they report to, or what they do.
Musk said recently that DOGE staffers do have to go through the same vetting process as other federal employees, but that doesn't necessarily assuage all the concerns here. In a court filing, the former acting chief of staff at the Social Security Administration says she believes DOGE staffers are accessing the agency's information from elsewhere in the government. She said that could mean some of the data protections don't work, or that other staff members around could be taking pictures of the information, transferring it elsewhere, or feeding it into AI programs.
As you mentioned, Elon Musk says he's targeting fraud and abuse. So that's the argument for needing this access then, to see where money is being wasted?
Right. And many people who work in government will tell you there are definitely things that could be more efficient and more modern. But there's a real concern that Musk's staff is being too hasty and that they don't understand these agencies or their systems. Career staff worry that DOGE could break things or come to the wrong conclusions about what they're seeing. We asked Doge for comment on what they're accessing and how they plan to use it, but did not receive a reply. And there are a number of laws that dictate how the government can collect and store your data. A core idea of those laws is that the government should have firewalls between agencies and not create all-encompassing profiles on Americans that could threaten our privacy.
Well, Laurel, what comes next?
Well, there's been more than a dozen lawsuits filed to halt DOJ's access to data at these different agencies. And as a result of these lawsuits, a judge might block or limit DOJ's access to certain databases. But all this is really a moving target. It's hard to know what's already been accessed or even copied.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, I'm sure this raises a lot of questions for folks. Is there anything that we can do about our own personal information?
Well, it's really challenging because you do have to give data to the federal government, and they already have it. We've trusted that that data would be safeguarded. And now here, there's these real questions about whether that data is being handled as carefully as it's supposed to be.
NPR's Laurel Walmsley, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
The days of checking your bags for free at Southwest Airlines are coming to an end. The Dallas-based airline announced several policy changes for customers. They are doing away with the popular free checked bags perk that was a favorite for discount travelers and families, including mine. The company has been trying to make up for lost revenue these last few years. Penelope Rivera with member station KERA reports.
Inside Dallas Love Field Airport, Kamari Robinson just picked up her luggage from the baggage carousel. She was flying in from her hometown of Chicago. She says she usually flies with Southwest, especially because her bags fly free.
I used Southwest last year with my ski trip, so having all that heavy equipment and big boots has helped me save money. So now, like, if I want to do another ski trip, I have to be coming out of more money. So it's kind of disappointing.
But this could be the last freebie for Robinson and thousands of others like her. The airline said starting May 28th, only A-list preferred members and people buying, quote, business select can check two bags for free. Other loyalty program members can fly with one bag for free, according to the company. But the average Southwest passenger will have to pay.
Their flights are already pretty expensive going just one way. So if I have to pay for bags on top of that, it will change the way I travel with Southwest.
The airline will also introduce a non-refundable basic economy fare, and flight credits will now have expiration dates, among other changes to fare bundles. For about half a century, the airline catered to customers with popular features like open seating and free bags. But last year, Southwest said it would end open seating in the second half of 2025. In recent months, new management has implemented revenue-driven changes trying to reverse losses after the pandemic and a winter storm in 2022, in which they were forced to cancel thousands of flights. The company had to pay a $140 million fine for that meltdown. Southwest Airlines CEO Bob Jordan said in a statement that the latest changes are intended to attract new customers. Hassan Thompson, who arrived in Dallas on Tuesday, said doing away with free bags is disappointing.
That's actually pretty surprising regarding the financial situation and how the economy is, makes that sort of decision. I won't be surprised if they lose a lot of their customers doing that.
With these changes, Southwest Airlines would be no different than other airlines charging baggage fees. The baggage policy will take effect May 28th. For NPR News, I'm Penelope Rivera in Dallas.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. As it tried to crush an uprising about a decade ago, the Assad regime ruling Syria faced a new problem. It had too many children in detention. An NPR investigation has found that intelligence agents placed over 350 of these children in orphanages across Syria's capital, Damascus. The agents ordered the orphanages to keep the children secret. Now, many of them can't be traced. NPR's Dia Hadid reports from Damascus.
In the fall of 2018, Assad security forces dragged a mother and her child from their home. They were taken hostage to pressure the woman's male relatives to surrender. The men were rebels. They'd joined the uprising against the regime that began in 2011 in their hometown of Dar'a. That woman was Sukaina Jabawi. She recalls she and her daughter Hiba were dumped in a dank cell, crammed with other women, children, babies. The little ones didn't stay for long. Guards soon ordered the mothers to hand them over. Jabawi says some of the mothers were crying and wouldn't let go of their kids. So the guards took them by force. Jabawi says she held Heba. She was just over 2 years old. She was infested with lice and losing weight. Heba, she told her, you're going to a better place. And she hoped that was true. Jabawi was freed a few months later. She had no idea where her daughter was. Her brother spent weeks pleading with bureaucrats to learn where Heba was and obtain papers to get her released. That was in the spring of 2019. Jabawi says their reunion, after 7 months apart, was bittersweet. Heba called her mama, but she didn't want to hug her. And yet, Jabawi is one of the lucky ones. Her daughter came back. The fates of the children of detained mothers emerged after rebel forces overran Damascus in early December and toppled the Assad regime.
Reports say that President Assad has left Damascus by plane.
That's when directors of some Damascus orphanages posted videos and did interviews explaining how intelligence agents came in white vans to their orphanages. They handed over children with a note demanding total secrecy. Weeks, even years later, agents took the children back. The director said they presumed the children were reunited with their mothers.
Assalamu alaikum.
One director, Ranal Baba, later told me they didn't have a choice. The agents handing over children, she says, belonged to the Air Force Intelligence Directorate, notorious for its torture, sexual assault, and murders of detainees. She says if we refused, they would have minced us into hamburger patties. The orphanages who took in the children of detained mothers included the Damascus branch of the SOS Children's Village. Tom Malvett, the regional director, says the Damascus branch took in those children over 4 years without telling the charity's headquarters. Malvett says they're now combing through branch records to work out how many children were placed there because staff didn't properly track them at the time. So far, they've found records for 139 children secretly placed at SOS Children's Village, but they can only confirm that 20 Syrian children were returned to their families. They're working with authorities to try to locate the rest.
We want to contribute to tracing children and families.
What happened to the children of detained mothers at another Damascus orphanage remains murky. The Life Melody Complex is a gated series of buildings on the outskirts of the capital. On a recent day, board member Nada Al-Khabara introduced us to the children in their care. Toddlers watched funny cartoons. Carers fussed over crying babies. Alhambra told us she's volunteered with the orphanage for years and knows most of the children. But she insists she had no idea that some of the children were not orphans, but were actually the children of detained mothers. Copies of the orphanage records were handed over to the Ministry of Social Affairs after rebels established a new interim government. An official showed NPR a list of 45 children placed in the Life Melody complex by intelligence agents. They say there may have been hundreds more over the years. The official spoke on condition of anonymity, fearing retaliation from members of the former Assad regime. It's unclear what happened to those children. These revelations have provoked fury among Syrians, but they've also kindled hope among the thousands of families whose children went missing during Syria's long war. We meet Hani al-Farra at an orphanage while he was searching for three of his children. They were detained with his pregnant wife at a regime checkpoint in 2013. Al-Farra says they were taken to pressure him to give information about rebels operating in his Damascus suburb. He says he refused to collaborate with regime forces, and for a long time he thought his wife and children were killed because of that. But now maybe he hopes his kids might have been left in orphanages. He shows their faded pictures to orphanage director Rana Al-Baba. Al-Baba shakes her head sadly, and so she directs him to another orphanage, the House of Mercy, tucked in a Damascus alleyway. There, girls practice a show to celebrate Syria's newfound freedom. The director, Bara' al-Ayoubi, tells us intelligence agents ordered them to take in about 100 children over the years, including babies of women who gave birth in detention. Al-Ayoubi says those babies were often sick. One newborn girl died shortly after she was handed over. Al-Ayoubi tells us she tried her best. She lobbied intelligence agents to let older children visit their detained mothers. And in 2019, she succeeded. So in the waning years of the Assad regime, some detained mothers knew where their children were. So in early December, after rebels toppled the Assad regime, rebels smashed open prison cells holding women. From there, orphanage director Bara' al-Ayoubi says many of them rushed to her orphanage. Al-Ayoubi shows us images of that day, mothers and fathers tightly hugging their children. It's a moment Al-Farra can only dream of as he searches for his missing wife and children. A few years ago, Al-Farra tried to move on. He remarried, had three more sons, moved to this busy Damascus street. But now his little boys keep asking about their older, missing half-siblings, especially their sister Islam. She was 5 when she disappeared. Today, she'd be 17. But the boys only know her as a little girl with sandy hair. Al-Farra says his sons ask him, "Why don't you go get Islam?" "I tell them," he says, "I swear, I'm trying." Dia Hadid, NPR News, Damascus.
This is NPR News.
Astronauts Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams have been on the International Space Station since last June. Now they're expected to return home on a spacecraft made by Elon Musk's SpaceX.
We came up prepared to stay long, even though we planned to stay short.
The next step in their extended journey on the next morning edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Coming up, how might President Trump's tariffs affect the price of beer?
You're talking about a massive increase in cost of goods for every brewer, big, small, medium, distillers, everybody.
The impact of tariffs on America's craft brewers, that's ahead after these news headlines.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. Ukraine has agreed to a U.S. proposal for a 30-day ceasefire in its three-year-old war with Russia. However, both sides are still far apart. Secretary of State Marco Rubio praised the agreement with Ukraine's president today, saying Washington will immediately restore military aid and resume intelligence sharing with Ukraine. Rubio says it's now up to Moscow.
We'll take this offer now to the Russians, and we hope that they'll say yes, to peace. The ball is now in their court. And but again, the president's objective here is number one, above everything else. He wants the war to end. And I think today Ukraine has taken a concrete step in that regard. We hope the Russians will reciprocate.
But big questions remain because Vladimir Putin has said he doesn't want a ceasefire. Instead, Putin has demanded that Ukraine never join NATO, and he wants control of at least four regions in the country. Tesla shares have dropped sharply to a five-year low as part of a weeks-long slide that began soon after CEO Elon Musk took on his role in the Trump White House. But as Villa Marx reports, the company faces a raft of other challenges, too.
After a weekend of protests outside several of its U.S. dealerships, Tesla's shares lost more than half their value by the end of Monday trading compared to a mid-December peak. Tesla's sales have also fallen significantly in several global markets, most notably China, Australia, and Europe, which saw a more than 45% annual drop in January sales. Some stock analysts say this is largely down to a retooling of Tesla's all-important Model Y, which prompted shortages and thus lower sales. But others argue Musk's outspoken criticism of countries like the UK and Germany has alienated international customers, while his role in cutting US government jobs has also damaged the company's brand. For NPR News, I'm Willem Marx in London.
President Trump showed his support outside the White House today for Musk, promising to buy a shiny new red Tesla from his most powerful advisor. This is NPR. A new production of Shakespeare's Othello, starring actors Denzel Washington and Jake Gyllenhaal, just set a new record on Broadway, earning more than $2.8 million last week. Here's Jeff London.
Audiences have been packing the 1,000-seat Barrymore Theater to see the two Hollywood stars in the classic tragedy and paying premium prices to be in the room where it happens. Single tickets for the best seats are close to $900 apiece, and the average cost per customer is over $360. In comparison, the previous Broadway box office record for Harry Potter and the Cursed Child was $2.7 million during Christmas week in 2023 in a theater with 600 more seats. Top ticket prices for other plays are considerably less. Othello is playing a strictly limited run of 15 weeks on Broadway. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
The Federal Department of Education plans to lay off nearly half of its 4,000 employees. The reduction in force notices have already been sent out to 1,300 workers as part of a government downsizing plan to close the agency. The Washington, D.C. and regional offices will be closed tomorrow as staff are advised to work from home. Sources tell ABC that employees will be offered 90 days with full pay and benefits and then terminated. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments, As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their client's best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice, at ajws.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. We have heard a lot about Greenland since President Trump said he wanted it to become part of the United States. Today, Greenlandic people vote on their own future in parliamentary elections. Let's hear more about that vote now from Adrian Murray, who's reporting from Copenhagen, which is the capital of Denmark. And Greenland is an autonomous territory of Denmark. Hi, Adrian.
Hi there, Juana.
I mean, Adrian, this is a really consequential election for Greenland. Tell us why.
Well, today's vote is seen as one of the most pivotal yet for the Arctic Territory's future, as the issue of independence has taken center stage in campaign debates for the first time. All the main parties want independence, but they differ in terms of what shape and what pace that should take. Here's the Prime Minister of Greenland admitted to being ill on his way to the polling station in Nuuk this morning, speaking with Danish public broadcaster DR.
The campaign has naturally been influenced by the geopolitical tension, the pressure on Greenland during a time where we have separation discussions between Greenland and Denmark, where Denmark will have to look itself in the eye and make concessions. And then we have the USA on the sidelines adding pressure, so it's a destiny election.
Adrian, tell us a bit more about where the different parties stand here.
Well, there were busy scenes at sports arenas and school halls in Nuuk this morning as residents lined up to vote. Now, of the six parties on the ballot paper, five favour independence from Denmark. The two largest parties, including Prime Minister Mette Ild's party IA, favour a more cautious and gradual approach. The biggest opposition party, however, wants a swift divorce from Copenhagen and to deepen defence ties with Washington. Recent polls show that around 80% of Greenlanders do back moves to separate from Denmark, but not at any cost. A majority would be more reluctant to do so if it meant lower living standards.
Adrian, I was in Greenland last month on a reporting trip that was in part sparked by President Trump's comments and his interest. And a lot of people that we talked to, they explicitly told us they did not want to be American. They wanted to be Greenlandic. What have you heard?
Well, that's right. Initially, I think Trump's comments were met with a mix of disbelief and bemusement. However, since taking office again in January, Trump has repeated again and again his intention to acquire the territory, notably because of its strategic location and mineral resources. And even though Greenland and Denmark's leaders have constantly rebuffed his demands, stating that Greenland is not for sale, last week he told Congress the US would get Greenland one way or another. Now, this continued rhetoric is beginning to worry some people who are starting to wonder if he really means it.
I mean, Greenland is just really in this intense geopolitical spotlight. What impact is that having on this election?
One newspaper editor said the independence debate has been put on steroids by Trump. Undoubtedly, the US president's interest has perhaps indirectly helped amplify some of those pro-independence voices. However, Trump's rhetoric is also creating fears among some of the people that if Greenland did get independence, it might become more vulnerable. Javier Arnott is the head of Arctic Social Sciences at the University of Greenland in Nuuk.
Many people are still skeptical of and fearful in a way of this rhetoric from the United States towards Greenland, because many Greenlanders know that the record of the United States with indigenous people is not very good.
Adrian, what can you tell us about the expected outcome of this election?
It is quite difficult to forecast, as there are few polls out there, but the Prime Minister is popular, and his handling of the situation with the US and also strong words for Denmark is likely to win him support. However, smaller parties like pro-independence Nellerek could also see gains, which might shake up the governing coalition. Now, there are just over 40,000 people who have the right to vote in today's election. And that's a small number when you consider the global interest.
That was reporter Adrian Murray in Copenhagen. Adrian, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Starting tomorrow, President Trump plans to impose a 25% tax on all imported steel and aluminum. He briefly threatened even higher tariffs, 50% on metal coming from Canada. This is the latest escalation in the president's trade war. Now, Trump also taxed imported steel and aluminum during his first term in office, but as NPR's Scott Horsley reports, those tariffs did not provide the boost to domestic manufacturers that the president promised.
Tariffs have the potential to raise prices, which is politically risky in a country where voters are already scarred by inflation. So Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick offered some reassurance on Sunday's Meet the Press.
Some products that are made foreign might be more expensive, but American products will get cheaper, and that's the point.
But that's not how it turned out the last time Trump imposed taxes on imported steel and aluminum. When the price of imports went up, many domestic steel and aluminum makers raised their own prices to match.
When a product is tariffed, the price rises for both domestically produced and imported products.
H.O. Woltz runs a company in Mount Airy, North Carolina, that buys hot-rolled steel wire and braids it into a cable used to reinforce concrete. Trump's original tariffs in 2018 were a double whammy for his company. Those tariffs forced him to pay more for raw steel in the U.S., but didn't apply to foreign competitors who could sell their own finished cable for less.
So we found ourselves with a market price for the raw material that was probably the highest in the world, but competing with world market prices for pre-stressed concrete strand because there's no tariff on it.
Woltz says those foreign competitors grabbed so much of the market, some of the domestic steel mills he used to buy from went out of business, the opposite of what the tariffs were supposed to accomplish. Many companies like Woltz's begged the Trump administration to either grant them a tariff waiver so they could buy raw steel at a lower price or tax the finished products their foreign competitors were selling. Christine McDaniel, who tracked those requests at the Mercatus Center, says it was a recipe for crony capitalism.
You don't want government picking winners and losers. The steel and aluminum tariff inherently is government picking winners and losers. The politically connected companies may have had a leg up in getting their requests approved.
As the trade war dragged on, unrelated businesses were caught in the crossfire. Europe retaliated for Trump's steel tariffs by adding a tax of its own on American whiskey. Chris Swanger, who heads the Distilled Spirits Council, says sales in Europe plunged by 20%.
The export market for the U.S. distilled spirits industry is a critical one. Distilled spirits shouldn't be in the line of fire, but we have been over the last 5 or 6 years, and it's had a detrimental effect on our industry.
Eventually, the steel and aluminum tariffs were relaxed, but now we're poised for a rerun. Canadian liquor stores are pulling American bourbon from their shelves, and Europe is threatening to tax American motorcycles and blue jeans. There is one difference this time around. The tariffs have been extended to cover more finished products, including the concrete strand that Woltz's foreign competitors make. That should help level the playing field, although Woltz is still worried about unintended consequences.
I don't really know what the solution is, but in terms of the world that we live and compete in the U.S., the solution is not to tear off one part of the supply chain and leave the rest of the supply chain to fend for itself.
Woltz says the real problem in the market is overproduction by China, and a trade war that pits other countries against each other does little to address that. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Congress wants to cut healthcare costs, and it is said one way to do that is for future doctors to get more nutrition training to better fight diseases like diabetes. How that's taught is up to each medical school. Corey Young with Alabama Public Radio sat in on one class in a kitchen.
Olive, zucchini, mushrooms, and whole wheat dough sit on the island of the teaching kitchen at the University of South Alabama. A group of medical students wearing crisp white aprons crowd around the ingredients. They're here to learn how to cook food as medicine. Connor Martin plans to be an internist, but says he was in the dark when talking with patients about diet.
I would give them like
pamphlets and stuff, but I would not really be able to like go in depth and explain it. And so that's why this course has been really helpful and exciting.
Today's lesson is carbohydrates. One of the teachers is physiology professor David Weber. He throws out some staggering numbers.
Average person in the U.S. eats 100 pounds of sugar per year.
100 pounds. The students are shocked. That's the reaction Weber hopes to get from his students. The idea is if doctors realize what their patients eat, they can ask better questions and give advice. As they work on their pizzas, Rachel Motamed tells her classmates about the last homework assignment, which was to cook something healthy. Motamed wants to go into psychiatry. She's been in this class for a month and says she gets it.
I want to emphasize like nutrition and wellness as a means of medicine, not just like a supplement to a medication.
That's the message Dr. David Eisenberg hopes all doctors understand. Eisenberg is director of culinary nutrition at Harvard. He was part of a group of medical professionals who published more than 30 nutrition competencies they want medical students to be tested on.
These are no longer competencies that are nice to have. They're competencies that one must have.
They include things like how to talk about food with sensitivity, understand the difference between minimally processed and ultra-processed foods, or explain food labels to patients. But they're far from becoming a requirement.
So we really eat the entire plant.
Back in the kitchen, the pizzas are in the oven, and it's time to make the salad. Dr. Bob Israel is showing students how to slice a fennel bulb to mix with oranges.
It's not a vegetable. You want to get a big old chunk of it.
He's the director of this kitchen and says teaching med students to cook is a lot like surgery. It's hard to tell someone how to cut a tomato or an onion, but
if they see it done and then do it themselves, it's a lot easier for them to envision themselves doing it.
The pizza is done.
That's pretty.
That's true. Wow.
For Connor Martin, the class was enlightening and a lot surprised him.
Oof. Honestly, a lot of the things that are in our foods that I wish I did not know, but I know now.
And now he may tell his future patients what's in their food. For NPR News, I'm Corey Young in Mobile, Alabama.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. The Department of Veterans Affairs has already cut several thousand jobs and intends to cut 80,000 more. It's also affected by President Trump's executive orders on gender and diversity. Among other things, the VA is one of the biggest providers of mental health care in the country, and some patients say they're already feeling the impact of these changes to their mental health. NPR's Katia Riddle reports.
A point of pride for mental health care providers at the VA, it's integrated into regular health care. Rashi Romanoff works with a nonprofit, the National Association of Veterans Research and Education Foundations, or NAVREF. They do advocacy around medical research at the VA.
They really invested a lot to have this feel like one experience that the patient is having.
Patients see therapists as part of their regular visits to the doctor. Romanoff says even though the VA has promised not to cut clinicians, any kind of change to this delicate medical ecosystem is disruptive.
So when you have this loss of personnel, you feel it in really, really, you know, significant and concerning ways when it comes to patient care.
One such patient, a woman who has to be identified only with her initials, DM. She's fearful of retribution for speaking out.
While I served, I was a victim of military sexual trauma or sexual assault from a fellow service member.
DM served nearly 26 years on active duty as a nurse. She worked through the trauma from the assault, but she took this lesson away from it. Anytime she's asked to meet with a man, never be in a room alone with him.
You don't go in there alone, even if you have to grab the office secretary. You make sure you are not one-on-one with that male, and that's to protect you and to protect him.
She says for female veterans like herself who have been sexually assaulted, seeing a male healthcare provider is threatening.
If that person taking your vital signs is a male and you've been traumatized by a male and that person's going to touch you and it's a stranger. Right there, that is gone by having that person you know is female when you're in the women's health clinic.
The women's health clinic through the VA, that's where she goes now to receive both mental and physical health care. But with the new executive orders around DEI and gender, she fears spaces like this will be eliminated from veteran and Army life.
We're going to get rid of anything that involves, you know, women, transgender, all that stuff. Well, right there, women's health clinics.
To be clear, the VA has not announced any plans to eliminate women's clinics. The executive order DM is referring to states that it is an effort to protect women. In an email statement to NPR, a spokesperson said, quote, the VA will always provide veterans, families, caregivers, and survivors the health care and benefits they have earned, unquote. DM is not reassured. Therapists say these kinds of perceived threats are destabilizing to their patients.
It's already hurting people's mental health.
This woman is a VA mental health practitioner. She asked only to be identified by her middle name, Lynn. She fears she will lose her job for speaking out.
We've had patients going to the medical records and asking for their charts to be altered and have like diagnoses rescinded and making changes to them to remove references to their gender identity or their sexual orientation, because again, they're fearing that they might be put on a list or that they might be discriminated against.
Another thing that's stressing people out, the fear that they'll lose their therapist. The VA's reassurances that they would not cut these positions have not been convincing, they say. DM has been working with one therapist for 2.5 years.
You know them, they know you.
She says she and other veterans are fearful of the women's health clinic being shut down altogether.
We walk in and we're like, is this going to be here next week? And what do we do if the door is closed? Like, we don't know what to do.
Before making changes to veterans' health care, says DM, she suggests officials talk to veterans, ask them what they want. Katie Riddle, NPR News.
Among the people worried about President Trump's tariffs are people who make beer, America's craft brewers. The administration's plans for sweeping import taxes would hit everything from barley to aluminum cans to steel kegs. Colorado Public Radio's Sarah Mulholland reports.
Two friends started Ska Brewery in Durango, Colorado, 30 years ago. Today, they produce 15,000 barrels of beer annually. Ska makes about 2/3 of its money selling beer at places like supermarkets and liquor stores. All that beer comes in aluminum cans.
Aluminum is the scariest for us.
President and co-founder Dave Thibodeau is worried about the 25% tariff on aluminum scheduled to take effect this week. The U.S. imports about half of its aluminum.
Cans are a lot cheaper than bottles, so it's kind of crazy. I feel like as far as looking at alternatives, like something other than an aluminum can, I don't know that we can get anything less expensive than an aluminum can, even after the tariffs.
Independent brewers get most of their malted barley from Canada because the big corporate brewers have contracts for most American barley. And Canada is also in Trump's tariff crosshairs. Dan Diebolt owns a craft brewery in Denver.
The grain is a product that I would be more concerned on with tariffs because our grain comes from all over the world and there's no telling who is going to become the target of that.
There's all kinds of steel, vats, and widgets. At this point, steel will be subject to the same tariffs as aluminum.
All these tanks came from China, so that could be affected.
Practically everything in Diebolt's brewery could be affected.
We have hundreds of supply points to actually make this brewery work and to try and know individually what's being affected by this is really, really hard to do on our scale.
Craft brews tend to be more expensive than macro brews like Coors and Budweiser. With beer drinkers getting pinched like everybody else by inflation, craft is a tougher sell. Scott Thibodeau says they're looking at discontinuing some beers.
Although they're beers we love, we started kind of looking at, you know, are these beers we can continue to make because they're not actually making us any money now. And we don't feel like we can really raise the prices too much more.
It's already a difficult time for craft brewers. Recent data shows declining alcohol sales in the U.S. And nationwide, craft brewery closures outpaced openings last year, with overall production down 2%, according to the Craft Brewers Association. Tariffs are just going to make the situation worse.
At some point, it just gets too expensive.
The big brewers aren't going to be completely unscathed, says Bump Williams, who runs a consulting firm for the alcoholic beverage industry. The major brands definitely have more buying power and more control over their supply chains. But at the end of the day, he says, everybody needs the same stuff to make beer.
You're talking about a massive increase in cost of goods for every brewer, big, small, medium, distillers, everybody.
Williams estimates the price of beer will increase by 3-8% if all the tariffs on the table actually come to pass. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Mulholland in Denver.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Dignity Memorial, helping families today to protect their loved ones tomorrow. Planning celebrations of life in advance can give families peace of mind. Learn more at dignitymemorial.com. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs. With online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses. At Easy Cater.
Should I move?